Hello, sports fans, and welcome to another edition of Yesterday Sports on the Sports History Network. And make sure to check out sportshistorynetwork.com/giveaways. I have two signed books I'm giving away. One is titled No Nonsense, Old School Weight Training, and the other is Reliving 1970s Old School Football.
You think about big numbers in NFL history. Number 16 is right up there with all of them. And we had a challenge with Aaron Harris and myself of coming up with the top players in NFL history that wore the number 16. Our results come up in just a moment.
This is the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch, a podcast that covers the anniversaries of American football events throughout history on a day-to-day basis. This is your host, Darren Hayes, and we're podcasting from the Pig Pen in Western Pennsylvania to bring you the memories of the gridiron, one day at a time. So with Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff supplying us with the tunes, let's go no huddle through today's football history headlines.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com.
Hello, my football friends. This is Darren Hayes of pigskindispatch.com, and welcome once again to the Pig Pen. For tonight, we are going to continue on that journey through NFL history by talking about the players and the jersey numbers that they wore. And tonight's guest is a special one, and I hope you enjoy this presentation of the number 16s. We are right in the middle of our Football by Numbers series that we have going on here for the greatest NFL players that wore a certain jersey number. And tonight, we are going to talk about the number 16 in NFL history. And boy, we have some great names to talk about. And joining us once again is Aaron Harris of the Football Odyssey podcast. You can find him on the Sports History Network. And Aaron, welcome once again to the Pig Pen.
Happy to be back.
Hey, just turn over one of those slop buckets and have a seat. We're going to talk some number 16s in NFL history here. We have tonight a little bit easier time of it coming in with our list. You know, it was a little bit of a struggle with our 15s. We only had three Hall of Famers. But with the number 16s, we have an amazing 11 players that were the number 16, according to the Pro Football Hall of Fame, that are in the Hall. And their names are, of course, we got Joe Montana, Len Dawson, George Blanda, Frank Gifford, Walt Kiesling, Ed Healy, Arnie Erber, George Musso, Ken Stabler, and Duke Slater. I don't think I'm missing any there. I think that was 11. I had to take my shoes off to count that. Talk a little bit about the Football Odyssey. Now, last night you told us a little bit about it, what it was all about. What do you have coming up that we can look forward to? So what do you have coming up and maybe listeners can look forward to, or maybe just an episode recently that we could go to learn something about football?
Well, an episode that I did recently was a couple episodes I did recently. One was with a former vice president of special projects for NFL Films. His name is Phil Tuckett. That was really fun. He gave me some great behind the scenes of some of his projects that he's worked on throughout the years. His story about how he got to NFL Films was great, and some of his early projects that he had to work on, and just some of the people that he got to work with. You know, he's definitely someone who has seen the game from two different vantage points. He was a player first for the Chargers, and then he made the leap over to NFL Films. So hearing his story was great. Then I got to talk to Tom Henschel, who's part of the Never Miss a Super Bowl Club, and hearing his stories about how he got to get the tradition started and some of his memories that he had with his family members going to every game, that was really special. But coming up, I got a episode, not sure when it's going to be released yet, but it's going to be with a couple filmmakers who actually produced a documentary a few years ago about Joe Roth, who was the University of California, Berkeley quarterback that died of melanoma, but he played his senior year despite his diagnosis. And also hoping to have a couple coaches on the podcast, and plan on hearing some film reviews too. I got a couple movies that I'm going to be doing reviews on, and then I'll release those episodes as well. So a lot coming down the pipe.
Yeah, sounds great. I mean, I listened to both of the episodes you just talked about, the Mr. Tuckett. That was a very interesting one, how sort of Ed Sable got him fired from the Chargers, got him cut so he could become a filmmaker. That was an interesting story he had. And also I listened to the gentleman with the Super Bowl Club. He had some great stories on how he got tickets, you know, writing the NFL, and, you know, interesting. Yeah, very interesting.
Yeah, his story about how he almost missed one of those games when he was in the hospital. And then the sister, the nun, is trying to keep him in. He's like, no, I got to get to the Super Bowl. I'm like, hey, man, persistence. I like it.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a gamer. Definitely. All right. Well, now we've got to get to our task at hand because we got a big chore tonight here in the pig pen. These number 16 is the greatest of the NFL. We already mentioned the Hall of Famers briefly, but who do you want to go into first?
Well, I think you and I and most everybody would agree who number one is Joe Montana.
Absolutely.
I mean, the guy, you know, won 4 Super Bowls, 3 Super Bowl MVPs. You know, he never had the strongest arm, never was the most athletic, but his main weapon was his intellect. And he's someone who played after my time, but I always enjoy, or I always take notice of anytime he makes a mistake, because a lot of people talk about how he's able to be cool under pressure. And I think that applies to the end of a game, but it also applies to me. Like after he throws an interception or a fumble, the guy just comes back and outperforms himself in the sense that he doesn't let that mistake weigh on him. He just goes out like it's a whole new game and he just does magic. You know, he does what Joe does. Like I was watching the catch a few weeks ago against Dallas, and Montana, I think, had like 3 interceptions that game. You know, but by today's standards, it really wasn't a good game that he had. But every time he threw a pick, you know, he just came back. He would go down for a touchdown, and you know, when the game mattered most, he knew what to do. So there's a reason why for years he was considered the greatest quarterback. And then you know, some people may still consider him it, but you know, he's definitely, if not number one, number two.
Right. It's interesting you bring up the catch. You know, that's sort of that mystery that sort of defines that play. Question is, was he trying to throw the ball away and it was just, a great reception, or was that just that well placed? Because he was under a little bit of duress. You know, he's sort of running for his life, heading towards the sideline and throwing back, you know, the middle of the field. And
just you got Ed Too Tall Jones just right up there. I mean, you got to throw that ball high if you got him coming at you.
Of course, Joe, I've seen some interviews with them when, you know, reporters ask him, well, were you throwing that ball away? Oh, you know, of course, his answer is, no, that's right where I wanted to put it. You know, we practice that play. So,
it's almost like the Immaculate Reception with like Frenchie Fuqua. His lips are always sealed about like the real, you know, did it touch him or Tatum? It's kind of like with Joe, you know, were you trying to throw it out or was that deliberate? You know, it's, I think that air of mystique kind of adds to the legend, you know?
Definitely, definitely. And I'm glad they don't tell. That's keeps that going.
Right.
Okay, definitely Joe Montana's, you know, top of our list for number 16s. Who'd you like to talk about next?
Number two, I put Bronco Nagurski.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, he's a guy I wish I could have seen him play live. You know, he kind of reminds me because he was 6'3", 245 pounds, and that's about the same size that Derrick Henry is. But, you know, you're playing back in the 40s. And you have a guy that's playing, you know, he's literally a man amongst boys. It's kind of like when a high school team, like a small high school, has like that really big player that they just feed the ball to, say, here, just take the ball and do something, run over people. And then you have everybody on the defense trying to tackle him, take him down. I mean, when you watch him, it's just amazing. And the fact that he was an all-pro at fullback, left the game to go into pro wrestling, came back and played left tackle. I believe he became an all-pro at that position too. And then in the championship game, he went back to being a tailback or a fullback and scored 2 touchdowns and helped them win the championship game. So if you want to talk about versatility, he took it to a whole other level because he contributed well on defense too.
Definitely. And I think I neglected to say him with the Hall of Famers. I think that was the one I was missing. But yeah, definitely Bronco Nagurski's in the Hall of Fame. And he also has a little bit of a controversy in his championship game that he played. I don't know if you're familiar with that story.
No.
And I forget who was playing the Bears at the time. It might have been the Portsmouth Spartans. Maybe I'm incorrect on there. But it came down. It was a real close game the whole game. And it came down to a play. Back then, the rule was the quarterback could only throw the ball if he was more than 5 yards behind a line of scrimmage. You know, this is the early 30s or late 20s, whenever that game was. And Nagurski ended up catching a pass from Red Grange, I believe. And they said that Grange was within like 2 or 3 yards of the line of scrimmage when he threw the ball. And, of course, you know, Nagurski caught the pass, scored the touchdown, and, you know, the Bears won by, like, 3 or something. You know, it was definitely the game-breaker. So that's still a big controversy with the
Did they have, like, checkerboard fields for that then?
I think that was long after the checkerboard fields. The checkerboard fields were more, like, when the forward pass was first starting out in, the early teens.
Because you had to be, you had to throw like 5 yards to like the left or right at least or something like that. So that was the way. I didn't know if that was the same rule they had going into the 20s. But
I think checkerboards, I think they had them only in the college game in those early teens years, okay. Like 1907 to 1913 or something.
Gotcha, okay.
So,
well, hey, you can't have a good championship game without some controversy, so.
No, most definitely. Great stories about Bronco Nagurski, great player, definitely in the top 12 of the number 16. So who would you like to talk about next?
For number three, I had Frank Gifford. And Frank, to me, I think, was kind of like the first modern NFL celebrity. You know, Red Grange early on in, you know, Prohibition and, like, you know, the roaring 20s and going into the 30s, you know, he was definitely the guy that was the first real pro player that everyone recognized. But I think Frank Gifford, in the era in which, you know, television was coming around and advertising had really taken on this whole life form of its own in many different mediums, I think he was a guy that kind of had turned the football player into being this sort of iconic occupation that it was. You know, he was doing cigarette ads, he was doing I think he had maybe a couple liquor sponsorships too. So it was cool to see, like, that transition, to see what people thought was just a lowly profession and see him just kind of make it a sexy profession, I guess.
And advertising all the vices.
Yeah. 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 But, but he, you know, he got that because he was a good player. You know, he won MVP in 56. He was first or second team all pro 6 years of his career. And, you know, for a halfback, he threw a lot of passes. You know, I see, like, a lot of those highlights where he's doing, like, those halfback option passes, and, you know, he could throw a good ball too. And he was the anchor for that offense when Vince Lombardi was the offensive coordinator. So I think he's definitely deserving of being on that high on the list.
I totally agree with you there. Definitely a great player. And he was a great broadcaster too, with Monday Night Football for years and years.
Yeah. Yeah. It's funny to listen to, like, going back, as, and I say this on my show all the time, I go through YouTube and I watch a lot of old games. And when you listen to, like, those Monday Night Football broadcasts, it's funny because it's like, you know, they're having, like, their own little party up in the booth while the game is going on. So it's like I can see why people would tune in, even if you weren't a football fan, just to hear the commentary from him and Cosell and
Dandy Don Meredith.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah. So, yeah, it's definitely, it was definitely more of an event, primetime football, than it is now. But
I mean, as big of a personality as Gifford was, to have, you know, Dandy Don and Howard Cosell in the booth with you,
yeah.
You were like fighting for airtime there yeah. in that booth, you know.
Yeah.
But definitely a great player, Frank Gifford. Definitely deserves to be on that list. Who'd you like to talk about next?
Len Dawson.
Ah, okay.
Yeah. And I'm curious to hear about your opinion on him, because so he finished his career with 239 touchdowns and 183 interceptions. And that's actually a better ratio than a lot of his contemporaries had, because, you know, a lot of quarterbacks from his time, they actually ended up with more interceptions than they did touchdowns. But he actually had a really good passer rating. You know, it was even better than some of the guys that followed him, like Aikman and Fouts and Warren Moon. And I read something interesting, that there were some people that considered him sort of like the prototype of Joe Montana. You know, he wasn't physically the most dominant guy. He didn't have the biggest arm. Wasn't really the most athletic, but he was very much a precision passer, very someone who played good percentages, but could also make, you know, big plays down the field when need be. So I'm kind of curious what your opinion, like, do you agree with that assessment? Like, do you think he was kind of like a Montana-esque player in that time?
I don't know if I've ever really thought about him playing, you know, like Joe Montana-esque. And I can't say that I've watched, like, full game films of him, because he was a little bit before my era of watching game. Well, I guess he did. He played till 75. So I just don't remember him as a player, except for, you know, like the Super Bowl when you know, watching those highlight games. Definitely. I always look at it. One of my favorite things for quarterbacks for comparison, and I'm talking the modern day quarterback, so let's say mid 70s till today, is that touchdown to interception ratio. Before, like, 1975, it's really throw it out the window. You sort of alluded to it when you were saying, you know, offenses counted more on the running game than they did the passing game for the most part. You know, it's sort of a 3 yards cloud of dust was still in there. They passed just to survive and get a first down most of the time. To have 239 touchdowns, 183 interceptions, like you said, that is an awesome ratio for that era of football. You know, and I mean, his career lasted from 1957 to 1975. I mean, just think about the changes that were in football and in the NFL. I mean, even the helmet technology and everything that happened in that 17, 19 seasons. That's just, that's an incredible era to play in, and to have, you know, the quarterback record also. He is 94, 57, and 8. And, you know, I hate to say this, but his first 3 years he was on the Steelers. You know, and they were Steelers of the 50s were not the they were in the cellar. You know, then played in with the Browns for a couple years in 60 and 61, the Dallas Texans in 62, and then the Dallas Texans, of course, turned into the Kansas City Chiefs and had a brilliant career, you know, 14 seasons with the Texans and Chiefs franchise. So I definitely think he should be on that list.
Yeah, and I think actually, too, Paul Brown had talked to Hank Stram and actually said you shouldn't sign him. Like, he didn't think he was a good enough player to be on a roster in any sort of professional league.
Huh. Yeah. That's interesting.
Yeah. So even the experts can get it wrong, you know?
Yeah, definitely. But, you know, winning that Super Bowl, he had some great Kansas City teams back then. So I definitely think he deserves to be there. All right, who else do we want to talk about?
So number five, I had George Musso. And okay. George was 6'2", 262. He was the first player to have NFL honors at two different positions. He was the all-decade team for the 30s. He was a four-time NFL champ. And he was named to the 75th anniversary all-time team, but for the two-way team. So they had two separate lists that year for people who had played, you know, two-way football, I guess, from, you know, the 20s all the way up till, you know, the earlier mid-50s. Which I thought was interesting. I didn't know they had, you know, a separate list for that. But, you know, he made the team, and, you know, he was a big boy, especially for the time he played. You know, not too many people that were going to move him off the line of scrimmage. And plus, you know, playing for the Bears, too. You know, if you were going to play for the Bears, you had to play good, strong physical defense. And, you know, four-time NFL champion, he served his part.
Yeah, absolutely. A great player in NFL history. I mean, like you say, you can't see too many on stats for, you know, an offensive lineman, defensive lineman, but and especially they didn't have the sacks and everything they were counting back then. But just, I mean, another great football name, you know, just his natural name, Musso. You know, you just associate it with a moose. And
yeah, you can. It's natural for him, yeah.
6'2", 262 pounds. That's a moose.
Yeah.
All right. Who do we want to go to next on our list here?
I went Duke Slater next. He was
okay, great choice.
All pro, 7 of his 10 years in the league, cleared the way for Ernie Nevers. And then by all accounts, he was athletic as anybody on those Cardinal teams that he played for. You know, he was someone who often required double teams when he was playing on defense too. And he earned praise from Fritz Kristler, Newt Rockne, and George Halas. You know, first lineman to make all pro in 7 seasons. So, you know, he was someone that definitely pioneered that position, no doubt, and really kind of, I guess, took a position that normally people, I guess, still today look over. But, you know, he definitely turned that position and dominated it.
Oh, most definitely. Our partner on the Sports History Network, Joe Ziemba, who's sort of the Chicago football expert, he has a whole episode, I believe, on Duke Slater, and it's a very interesting episode. It's one of Joe's older episodes, but just some of the stories that come out of that, it's really good. But he started off, you know, some teams that we don't even think of, some defunct teams in the NFL. You know, the Milwaukee Badgers is who he played for, and the Rock Island Independents, you know.
Yeah.
Those are the two teams. And he goes the Chicago Cardinals, and it's you know, just some great football lore and a real trendsetter and trailblazer for, you know, the African-American player, you know, playing back in that era of football. That's a great thing. You know, played from 1922 to 1931 in the NFL. And great player, Duke Slater.
And he actually he became a judge after his career as a
football player.
Yeah. I think he – I don't remember where he went to school, but yeah, he had a law degree and he ended up becoming a judge.
Wow, that's awesome. You know, they have great careers after football. You love to hear that.
Yeah.
And the players can make it. Okay, so we have Duke Slater on that list. So that takes us – that's 7 of our 12 that we have filled up. Who would you like to talk about next?
George Blanda.
Great player.
Yeah, he was a guy that if he could have played in a wheelchair, he probably would have. You know, he was first guy to score 2,000 points in the NFL. You know, just as long as he played, is an undeniable achievement. You know, he's the 3-time AFL champion, and you might know differently, but from what I've seen, he was actually the first professional quarterback that I think utilized the spread formation. And one of the earliest games I've seen on YouTube is the 1962 AFL Championship game between the Houston Oilers and the Dallas Texans right before they went to Kansas City. And it's not like a spread formation that we think where you have, you know, two receivers line up way outside the numbers, a couple slot receivers. I mean, you still have a tight end, you know, two receivers, and then you have basically like two wingbacks. But yeah, you know, he's by himself. He's dropping back. He's throwing the ball, you know, all over the field. And that's the first time I've seen in pro football. I mean, I know in college you had some colleges that were running the spread, you know, in the early 50s, like at TCU. But yeah, he was running that offense to, you know, great efficiency. He was a fun player to watch. And, you know, a guy that's as old as he was being able to stick around and still contribute to his team. I mean, you got to put him on the list.
Oh, absolutely. He has kind of an interesting story why he left Chicago. I'm not sure if you're aware of it.
Mm-mm.
But he played for the Bears for many, many years. I mean, he started off with the Bears in 49 and then bounced around a little bit, but came back to the Bears and played all the way to 1958. But he was kind of mad at George Halas because Blanda wanted to be a quarterback, and Halas considered him, well, you're the backup quarterback, but you're our kicker. And Blanda wasn't real fond of that thing, but he really didn't have many choices. So in 1959, he retired from football. When the AFL kicked in 1960, they begged him to come out of retirement. You know, the Houston Oilers ownership did. And he joined the Oilers, and they promised him, you know, some quarterback, at least the opportunity to start at quarterback. And he did, and he did some kicking there and had a great second career, you know, with the AFL as a quarterback. So
yeah. I think he has a quote. I don't know if I'm getting it precisely what he said, but he said, "I'm not a kicker. I'm a quarterback that kicks."
Right, right.
Something like that. Yeah,
I do remember something to that effect. Yes, but yeah, definitely George Blanda should be on our list here. All right, so we have 8. We're looking for 12. Who do we want to talk about next?
I threw Kenny Stabler on the list, and
another Raider quarterback.
Yeah. I probably would have put him a little higher if he would have had the same success with 16 as he did with 12. But, you know, he was a fun quarterback to watch. You know, he has all-around athleticism. You know, left-handed quarterbacks can be kind of drastically different in terms of they either throw a really pretty ball or they throw just like this weird wobbly ball that just looks awkward even to watch. But he was a guy that had a nice spin on the ball. And he always kept his team in contention all the way to the end. And, you know, if it was for Pittsburgh, we could be looking at the Raiders as the dynasty of the 70s. So,
oh, they definitely could.
There's something to be said for that as the quarterback that, you know, really kept those Raiders teams down to the wire, usually in the AFC Championship game during that tough decade.
Yeah, I mean, here's a perfect example of what I was telling you about the quarterback rating or quarterback touchdown to interception ratio. You know, that's sort of that era I'm talking about. I sort of discount because Stabler was 194 touchdowns, 222 interceptions, but his quarterback record as a starter was 96-49-1. So those numbers really don't match up, but I think it's just that solid running game and in that era.
I mean, today it's just a turnover is so consequential, you know, because I think nowadays, you know, moving the ball, because, I mean, if you get a turnover, you know, you could just throw up a 50-yard bomb and get a pass interference, and then you could be right there in the red zone, you know? So it seems like back then, you know, if you really wanted to, you know, if you had a turnover, you know, you could rely on defense to play some tough ball. But, yeah, it definitely seems like you could take more chances back in the day, or, you know, risk-taking was more natural, I guess, or more natural part of the game than it is today. And I guess, too, because they were throwing the ball a lot deeper than they do now. You know, now I think it's more of a horizontal game, whereas back then, you know, if you wanted to pass, you just kind of launched it.
Right. I mean, the defensive backs had a little bit more freedom to, destroy a receiver if they wanted to and, you know, hold them down the field and everything.
Yeah.
So that definitely, you know, takes some effect into what the totals are.
Yeah.
But his career, I always sort of paralleled him with Bradshaw because they both came in. Bradshaw came in 69 to a team that he sort of turned the fortunes around. You know, Stabler came into the Raiders in 1970. They both wore number 12 for Stabler for many years, Bradshaw for all his years. took their teams to the top of the AFC, faced each other many times, weren't the true number one quarterback their first few years with their respective teams. You know, Stabler had Daryl LaMonica that he was battling with for a few seasons. He was unseeding, and they went back and forth there a few times, you know, where Bradshaw was, you know, had Joe Gilliam and Terry Hanratty that he was competing with. So, but great quarterback. It's a shame that the Raiders let him go and he went to Houston and New Orleans, because that's sort of his career sort of like fell off when he got away from John Madden.
Yeah. And I think too, I think Daryl LaMonica was the quarterback for the Immaculate Reception game until he was benched for Stabler, I think, in the second half or maybe even the fourth quarter. And that's when he had that run that basically gave him that 7-6 lead.
Right. Yeah. Stabler got him back in that game.
Yeah. So he's another guy too I wish I could have seen in my time, because he seems like a quarterback like Joe Namath in a lot of ways, kind of like that devil may care attitude, you know, the kind of guys that could just go out. And I think Bobby Lane is another guy too. They could just go out till, you know, 3-4 o'clock in the morning and show up and play on Sunday.
Yeah, definitely. And he also had that nefarious play where the holy roller play against San Diego.
Yeah.
So he sort of pushed it forward, and, you know, I think it was Dave Casper's tight end ended up falling on it in the end zone, and they beat the San Diego Chargers. It was late in the season, and I think knocked San Diego out of the playoffs or put them in a wild card in Oakland.
Something like that.
It was something of that effect.
Yeah.
It made a difference in the season for San Diego. But
very,
very good player, Ken Stabler.
They had a lot of memorable plays too. It's like there was the Holy Roller, the Sea of Hands, the Ghost of the Post. It seems like I don't know if he was the quarterback for Ghost of the Post, but it seems like they always had just some sort of crazy play every season that got into NFL lore.
Well, even his college game with Alabama, the run in the mud, that was Kenny Stabler.
What is
run
that?
In the mud. If you ever get,
I've never heard of that.
You never heard?
No.
YouTube it tonight. You know, one of Bear Bryant's crowning moments. It was a real tight game. I believe it was an Iron Bowl game, so it was against Auburn.
Mm-hmm.
And I forget the logistics of the game, but it was a real close game. Alabama's down. It's a real muddy field. They used to play the Iron Bowl in Birmingham every year at the Legion Field, I think it was called. Mm-hmm. And it was sort of a quagmire in this game. Yeah, real close game, and all of a sudden, Kenny Stabler scrambles and does almost similar to what he did against Pittsburgh in that Immaculate Reception game. Just has this great run that you think he's going down a bunch of times, but he escapes and scores a touchdown, and ends up being the victory points that the Alabama needed to knock off Auburn.
So, some guys just have the magic.
Yeah, he definitely was. It's just that will, there's something about him. Got the it factor,
Yeah, definitely.
All right, we have Kenny Stabler as our ninth choice to go on our list. Now, who do we want to talk about next? We still have some Hall of Famers on the board here, too.
Well, another one that I had was Arnie Herber.
Oh, yes.
And Arnie wasn't a guy that I was really familiar with until I was, coming up with a list for this, but he was kind of, I think a lot of people considered him and Don Houston to be the first quarterback receiver combination, the first dynamic one in the NFL. And a lot of people would consider Arnie to be the, I guess, kind of like the one that paved the way for guys like Sid Luckman, Sammy Baugh to come in. I think he had the most touchdowns he had in a season was like 11, which, obviously, some people get, 11 touchdowns within two or three games today. But I think back then, I'm not even sure if they were playing 12 games back then. But, to be able to throw 11 touchdowns when most teams are still running the single wing or just trying to pound the ball any which way, that's a pretty good accomplishment. And, he actually led the league in multiple passing statistics for a few years, three all pros, and I think had three or four NFL titles. So you got to put him in there. Yeah.
Here's an interesting fact about him. Not so much about his career. He was born Green Bay, Wisconsin, went to high school, Green Bay, Wisconsin, college, Wisconsin Regis, you know, College. Played for the Green Bay Packers. He was just a hometown boy, never left home. You know, hometown hero. You know, like you said, connection with Don Hutson, that who was the definitely the greatest wide receiver of his era.
Right.
And you know, Herber's the one that threw most of those passes that Hutson caught. So yeah, just a phenomenal player. I was hoping you'd say him because I think he definitely deserves to be on our list. Okay, where do we want to go next here? That's our 10th.
9th or 10th. I have him as number 9 on my list, yeah.
Okay.
For 10, I went with Jim Plunkett.
Okay.
This could be kind of like a volatile topic for some people because there are some people that think he should be in the Hall of Fame without question. Others are okay with him not being in it. You know, he has 2 Super Bowls, and he had a great story behind him. You know, he gets drafted by the Patriots. It doesn't pan out there. He goes to the 49ers. Same ordeal. He doesn't pan out there. But when he goes to the Raiders, you know, he gets a 8-2 playoff record. He had average numbers. He was never really one of the top quarterbacks in any area he played in. But, you know, he could move around. He could throw on the run. He had a good arm. And, you know, frankly, he never really let the moment get to him. You know, for a quarterback that's had a subpar career like he did, you know, whenever – he's thrust into having to win 2 Super Bowls. You know, the guy didn't really had seemingly no pressure on him. So definitely someone I don't want to say definitively or not if he should be in the Hall of Fame, but I definitely think he should be on this list.
I'm sort of on the fence. I've looked at him. I'm on the fence if he should be on the list.
Oh, yeah.
And here's why. I mean, definitely the Super Bowl championship. You know, that definitely is. The 1980 NFL Player of the Year, you know, Comeback Player of the Year. Quarterback record for his career, and he had a lengthy career, sort of almost mirrored Bradshaw and Stabler we were talking about, from 71 to 1986. So played in that 1970s and 1980s. Mm-hmm. But, you know, 72-0 is a quarterback record as a starter. Just under 26,000 yards for that length of career. 164 touchdowns, 198 interceptions. So the numbers aren't great, but he's got the hardware. That's what I'm saying. He's sort of got me on the fence a little bit. And I think there's some other names I would consider to be talked about with him to make this list. Maybe that's one that you can convince me about here later after we talk about some of these other names.
Yeah, we could revisit. Like we could revisit Jim.
So I'm gonna put him on a standby here right now. We'll come back to him. Who is your next one on the list? You said you had a
line. I had Josh Cribbs.
Oh, okay. Yeah. That wasn't somebody I was thinking about, but okay.
Yeah. So Josh is. I think most people would acknowledge Devin Hester as the best returner. I mean, whether you're going punts or kickoffs. But, you know, Josh was impressive in his own right. I mean, I think especially he primarily made his money off of kickoff returns. He was an all-pro 2 times. He was the all-decade team. And he's actually tied for kickoff return touchdowns. So special teams is really where he made his name. He never really contributed much on offense aside from, you know, some special tier gadget plays. But he was a guy that could turn a game around. I mean, I know especially – you know, being a Steeler fan, watching him go up against Pittsburgh a couple times, he definitely made them pay the price a few times. I can remember one game. I think it was 2009 when it was like they were on like a 4-game losing streak, and they needed to win. All they needed to win was like one more game to get in the playoffs. And this is at this point, there's only like a month left in the season, and they go for a Thursday night game in Cleveland, and I think he returns a kickoff or a punt for a touchdown and kind of puts a nail in the coffin because I think they sacked Ben Roethlisberger like 9 times in that game. So, like, good defense and special teams by him won him that game, and that virtually was the game that kind of kept him out because they had went out and need help from there. But if they would have won that game, they would have gotten in.
That's a good point. I didn't even consider Cribbs on here, but you definitely make a compelling case for him, and you're right. I sort of forgot he was quite the weapon they used him on a little bit on offense too. Almost, you know, if they would have had a little bit more wildcat in the NFL back then, he probably would have been a great wildcat player.
Yeah, he did. Yeah, he ran in like some plays, and then they would do, you know, some of like those end arounds or, you know, some plays where they can get him out in space as if, you know, he was in a kick return or a punt situation. But yeah, he definitely had a few years where he was one of the most recognizable players in the game. not sure if he'll ever get any Hall of Fame candidacy or if he ever should, but you know, he was a fun player to watch, and I think he stood out at his position, and a position that's very hard to make a living in, especially nowadays.
Yeah, very, very interesting with the Josh Cribbs thing.
Yeah.
Huh. Yeah, I like that pick. We'll have to put him as a one to come back to here too. Okay. Is that it for what you have for lists?
Yeah, those are the players that I wanted to make a case for.
Okay, we have two Hall of Famers that are on, that we haven't talked about, and I think definitely we should bring those two up. The first one's Walt Kiesling, and we talked about him in an earlier number in this series. But he had a great career. He played from 1926, where he played with the Duluth Eskimos, and then played a couple years there, then played with the Pottsville Maroons, the Chicago Cardinals for a good amount of seasons, the Bears for a season, Green Bay Packers, and then finished up his career as a Steeler in 1937-1938. And he was another one that was a guard tackle position, 6'3", 260. He was in the Hall of Fame, like we said. It was 1 year he made All-Pro, had an NFL championship under his belt. Is the on the All-1920s team, Hall of Fame team. Definitely think, definitely want to talk about him because of being in the Hall of Fame. And it's in one of those eras where there's not a lot of stats, especially for a lineman, but a very good player that's highly regarded. So I'd like to put him on our maybe list to discuss, to put on our top 12. I'm not saying put him on the list right now, but one to have under consideration, I guess I'm trying to say.
He eventually coached the Steelers, didn't he?
Yes, he was a coach in the NFL. Too,
yeah.
So
yeah, I think I know him more as a coach than I do as a player. But yeah, I mean those linemen, especially from the pre-statistic days. I mean, it's kind of, I think it's easy to take for granted, but you know the kind of offenses they were running, you know, they required a lot of thinking for the offensive linemen too. I mean, you know, they're running all kind of crazy trick plays and reverses and, like, you know, crazy laterals and everything like that. So I think offensive linemen pretty much had to have a good handle on the overall offensive scheme as opposed to just plowing through up the middle like the game would become, you know, going into the 50s.
Most definitely. Yeah. A lot of pulling and traps and things like that. So and the other Hall of Famer that we didn't really talk about is Ed Healy. And Ed was another one that was a, you know, tackle, guard, and end on defense, two-way player. He played from 1920 through 1927. Another Rock Island Independent player, Chicago Bears, where he had most of his career, though. Six years with the Bears, 3 years with Rock Island. Again, not a lot of stats on him, but he is in the Hall of Fame, four-time All-Pro. And also on that Hall of Fame team of the 1920s with Kiesling. I would say he's probably even a stronger consideration with the four All-Pros than even Kiesling is.
Yeah, four
consideration.
Four All-Pros when he played seven seasons. That's a pretty good standout. Yeah.
Then everything's sort of mediocrity of our other players, but you know, some players to mention, you know, Vinny Testaverde's on there. He wore the number 16 for nine seasons from 1998 to 2007. I don't know if I would put him, he would make the list, but definitely somebody to talk about. I mean, his record was 90-123-1, so not a very good record. Touchdowns 275-267. That's why he sort of got that name of Vinny Interceptaverde, they call them. You know,
I never heard that.
Started off, played many years with some poor Tampa team, 6 years in Tampa. Then he went to Cleveland for three seasons, sort of unseated Bernie Kosar. And Kosar got sort of booted out of town. The Browns then went to Baltimore, so he played with the Ravens for a couple seasons. Then finished up his career with playing for the Jets and Dallas and New England and Carolina and sort of that dependable backup. Had a good career, you know, had a great college career with the Miami Hurricanes under Jimmy Johnson. I believe he has a Heisman, if I'm not mistaken. I think he won the Heisman. Definitely somebody to mention on this list. Another player that's on there is Jake Plummer, were the number, another quarterback.
Jake the Snake.
Jake the Snake, you know, the Cardinals for a little while and the Broncos. Jared Goff is on there. He wore it for four seasons, you know, kind of a controversial player right now, but I think a certain Arnie Chapman's going to endear him here in this coming season.
Yeah. I don't think we're going to endear him for this list, though.
No, I don't think so either. Yeah. And another interesting wide receiver is Lance Moore, wore that number 16 for 9 seasons. Not saying that he should be on the list, but just sort of his resume: 389 receptions, 44 touchdowns, just over 4,800 yards of receiving. You know, played for the Saints and the Lions, and 1 year in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't really have a good year with the Steelers, which could have been something great, but solid player, just worth mentioning here. So do you have anybody else that you'd like to talk to for our consideration?
No, those were all the guys that I had similar feelings on.
Okay, now let's see. We have a solid 9. Let's just review here. The 9 that we have on here: Joe Montana, mm-hmm. Len Dawson, Bronco Nagurski, George Blanda, Frank Gifford, Arnie Erber, George Musso, Kenny Stabler, Duke Slater, and in our ones that are consideration, we have Josh Cribbs. 9. Now we have 9 on the list. We need to pick 3 of these players: Jim Plunkett, Walt Kiesling, Ed Healy, and Josh Cribbs. Your Cribbs pick and your Plunkett pick, I think, are solid, and I would agree with you putting them on that list.
Yeah, I think if I had to pick one of those guys, I'd probably put Cribbs, because I think he had more of an impact on his position than Plunkett had on his.
Okay.
Yeah, I think Cribbs stood out much more. And, you know, we can have the debate as if it's harder to stand out as a quarterback or as a kick returner. And, you know, maybe we can draw the same conclusion for different reasons. You know, kick returners are kind of far and few in between who are going to really make their name known. Whereas quarterbacks, you know, you could have a lot of good ones, so it could be hard to keep pace with it. I just think Cribbs had more of an impact on the game, and he was someone who was more threatening when he was on the field. So I would put him on there before I put Plunkett in.
Okay, that's sort of where I'm leaning towards, too. I'm thinking, you know, two of those, we got to pick 3 of them, and 2 of the 4 are in the Hall of Fame already. And I'm not sure Josh Cribbs is ever going to get a sniff of the Hall of Fame.
Yeah.
And Plunkett may get there, but I'm not sure that he will either. I mean, the Super Bowl championship definitely helps. But Kiesling and Healy are already in the Hall of Fame, and I almost think I think I'd pound my fist on there that I think those two ought to get 2 of those.
Yeah,
two of those 3 spots.
Well, Healy, I agree with. I mean, 4 years as a All-Pro out of 7 seasons. I mean, that's a pretty good resume. Yeah, Kiesling, I'm still not too familiar with what he's done as a player. I still think of him as a coach. It's hard to say too. You know, sometimes like those journeymen from back in those early days, from like the 20s going into the 30s, seems like they didn't really maybe stick around long enough with the team, either because maybe they just wanted more money to play elsewhere or because they just weren't good enough for that team. So it's hard to judge that pre-statistic era, but although if he's in the Hall of Fame, I guess it's for good reason, so perhaps we should put him in there before Plunkett.
Okay, so We'll round out our top 12 with Kiesling, Healy, and Josh Cribbs. And we'll put Jim Plunkett as an honorable mention or a 12B maybe or something, however you want to say it. So I think that's a pretty solid list. And that's probably the most challenging of the numbers that we've come across so far.
16?
I mean, the 16. Tens and 12s, there was a lot of good players in those ones, and we had to make some choices at the end. But this was probably the hardest at the back end of that to choose players, especially when there's 11. We're talking about, you know, possibly taking Hall of Famers off that list, too. That's where that conversation did. So that was a great discussion. I really appreciate you being here, Aaron Harris of the Football Odyssey. We want to make sure everybody can know where to find you. So I don't know if you have any social media tags you want to throw out there. So
yeah, you can find me on Twitter at Football Odyssey, and then I have an Instagram page as well. I post those links in every episode that you can get on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, that you're wherever you get it. So just click the link and it'll take you directly towards my social handles.
Okay, and how about your website? Because your website's outstanding. I haven't really talked too much about that, but you really have some good stuff on there. And I know we've talked a little bit about it in email and stuff, but tell us a little bit about the website.
Yeah, so like I mentioned in the previous episode, that this was a venture that originally began as a blog, where I was blogging just about football history topics and things of that nature. Since I've been doing the podcast, I haven't been writing in there as much, but it's definitely something I want to get back in the swing of and revisit. So I have some articles that I'm in the middle of writing right now, and I don't have a timetable of when those will be released, but it should be soon enough. So definitely want to get some more design on the website as well, and then put the podcast up there as well, so it can be kind of like a one-stop shop as well. So,
excellent. Well, we look forward to that. Let us know when some of those post up there, and we'll make sure we let everybody know about them. And we definitely got to have you on again for some of these numbers. We still have 80-some numbers to go through here. So, yeah. So we definitely, it's been a good time, and we appreciate your time you've taken with us this evening and having this great discussion of NFL great number 16s.
Yeah, man, I'm happy you had me on. This was a good task to do. You know, sometimes you get kind of lost in the shuffle with like how many players wore which number. So to be able to go back and like look at these guys and kind of compare and contrast them and see, you know, who was really the best at this certain number. It's a unique topic. So keep it up, man. I'm glad this series is going well. Looking forward to the next one.
All right. Thank you very much. And we'll see you in a future episode here. And we'll also check you out on the Football Odyssey podcast. Yeah. And it's on, believe weekly or you're bi-weekly on that.
Yeah, I'm trying to make it a weekly thing. Sometimes it can be bi-weekly, but I definitely try to get at least 3 episodes a month. I shoot for 4, but, you know, 3 is definitely, you'll hear 3, at least 3 a month.
All right, awesome. Just check out that Football Odyssey podcast, Sports History Network, or go to, you know, Aaron's social things. We'll also post those on the show notes of this, and you can check that out. And thank you once again, Aaron Harris, for joining us on the Pigskin Daily History Dispatch podcast.
Thanks for having me, and hopefully I'll be able to have you on my show too. We can go into a deep dive discussion about your football journey. Take it easy.
Well, what a great discussion we have with Aaron Harris. We really appreciate him being able to join us. The last two numbers, 15s and 16s. What a great thrill that was to have some great insight from the Football Odyssey. And so we're going to continue on in our series. We're going to go to the 17s. It's going to be a solo version. And then the number 18s, we're going to bring back Joe Ziemba, the great historian and author of some great books on Chicago football history, and his insight on the number 18s. Then we're going to go to 19s. We're bringing in the Brothers Newman from the Hello Old Sports podcast. And then number 20s, we'll have Arnie Chapman, the football history dude himself, will join us here on the program. So that's what you have coming up to look forward to. And we also are going to put in there a great interview we had on March 17th with Jennifer Taylor Hall, the author of Amos Alonzo Stagg, College Football's Man in Motion, as we talk about the great innovator of the game, Amos Alonzo Stagg. You don't want to miss those episodes. So till tomorrow, everybody, have a great gridiron day. Peeking up at the clock, the time's running down. We're going to go into victory formation, take a knee, and let this baby run out. Thanks for joining us. We'll see you back tomorrow for the next podcast. We invite you to check out our website, pigskindispatch.com, not only to see the daily football history, but to experience positive football with our many articles on the good people of the game, as well as our own football comic strip, Cleat Marks Comics. Pigskindispatch.com is also on social media outlets, Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and don't forget the Pigskin Dispatch YouTube channel to get all of your positive football news and history. Special thanks to the talents of Mike and Gene Monroe, as well as Jason Neff, for letting us use their music during our podcast.
This podcast is part of the Sports History Network, your headquarters for the yesteryear of your favorite sport. You can learn more at sportshistorynetwork.com. Hey there, Sports History fan. This is Arnie Chapman, a.k.a. the Football History Dude, and I wanted to thank you for stopping by to listen to another episode here on the Sports History Network. Our podcasters are passionate about uncovering and sharing sports stories from yesteryear. And if you didn't know it already, we have over 30 shows across the network covering all sorts of sports history topics. In fact, here's a glimpse into one of our awesome podcasts here on the network.
Each week, the official Football Learning Academy podcast will take you deep into the history of pro football through interviews with players, coaches, or administrators in the NFL, as well as interviews with Pro Football Hall of Fame selectors, authors, and historians, you'll learn how the game evolved and important moments that shaped the sport into what it is today. And don't miss the Pro Football History Nugget of the Week. Listen to the official Football Learning Academy podcast on the Sports History Network.
How about that? I bet you're super hyped to go listen to that new podcast, right? Well, to learn about this show and all the other podcasts on the network, head over to sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Again, that's sportshistorynetwork.com/podcasts. Head over there today to find your next favorite sports history podcast.